by Reverend Andrew Martlew. You're listening to Radio 4 FM. In a quarter of an hour, Keris Matthews drops in on Woman's Hour to discuss the new musical about Carole King, and she'll be considering who the top female singer-songwriters are today. Before that, we continue with our book of the week, Shop Girl by Mary Portis. The young Mary is relishing the new sounds and styles of the 70s, but her busy, cosy family life is hit by the most unexpected tragedy.
Ready, Mary? My eldest brother Michael is holding the needle over the Bush record player. No, no, wait, says my sister Tish. Her hair needs a bit more back combing, doesn't it, Joe? Joe agrees. And since they are all older than me, I give in. So Joe walks up to me and pulls at the tuft sticking up from my head. He wiggles the comb up and down my hair for what feels like forever before telling Lawrence to get the silver crin. The air around me is filled with fumes as he sprays. Finally, I am ready. Michael drops the needle and there's a few seconds of crackling before the music starts. Piano notes, overlaid with bass guitar and drums. I start swaying in front of my brothers and sisters as I wait for Bowie to begin to sing.
Small Jane genius, snuck off through the city, strung out on lasers and slashed back blazers and ate all your...
Spinning on the turntable is the latest LP we've bought, A Lad Insane by David Bowie.
New York's a go-go and everything tastes nice. Poor little greenie.
Lawrence hands me the mirror and I stare at myself. My temples and cheeks are dusted with fuchsia eyeshadow. And there's a huge red zigzag, edged in blue, running from my forehead down over my right eye and onto my cheek. My hair looks as if I've just stuck my finger in a plug socket. I look like a miniature version of Bowie himself. Brilliant! I squeak. Mum walks into the room and looks at me singing. Ah, don't you look grand, she says. For my mum, rules had to be followed when it came to behaviour and school. But fashion, music and art were never censored. When she leaves, I hardly notice. I'm lost in the moment. Michael, Joe, Tish and Lawrence are my audience. And there's nowhere else I'd rather be. The fashion for flares perplexes my mother. But I've been desperate for a pair of Oxford bags for months. Now I'm wedged behind a curtain beside a stall at Watford Market. My mother is holding up a tiny mirror in front of me in the driving rain. Mark Bolan wears these trousers, and I want to wear them too. My passion for him burns as brightly as ever, and David Bowie is now my other god. Mum is intrigued by these musicians. Dad is confused. Are they fellas? He keeps asking whenever they appear on telly. But those men fascinate me with their androgynous looks, skinny frames and clothes that blur the boundaries of all I've ever known. It's not just what they wear. It's the way their clothes are used to express something that I don't fully understand. It's the first time I've realised clothes can say something about you. Tell the world what you want it to know. After a decade of mostly clean-cut pop stars, glam rock boys who look like girls wearing silk and glitter, ruffles and eyeliner appear on top of the pops as if from another world. It's 1974 and the world is changing, even in Watford. Mum started wearing mustard slacks. People are eating something called chicken chow mein, and the sweet shop is being run by Mr. Hussein, who is from Pakistan. At home, things are on the move too. My big sister Tish has started going out in the evenings with friends like Khalid and Zephyr, who make me gasp in admiration because they wear five-button high-waisted Oxford bags. I envy her and my older brothers. Tish has got a Saturday job at Boots, and I want to die when she brings home Rimmel lipsticks and 17 eyeshadows that she buys with her staff discount. And I am counting down the days until I can get a job too. There are 1,045 to go. For now, All I can do is badger my mother to buy me something. And I've spent weeks pleading for some trousers to wear to Linda Barnes's birthday party. I finally persuaded her to get me them. I stare at myself with pleasure. Cream with a large orange check. The Oxford bags hug my skinny body perfectly. I'm sitting in a careers advice interview with Sister Angela, a nun who has only ever worked for God. My O-levels are coming up and I have to pick my A-levels for next year. I tell her I want to study art, sociology and English. I'm aware I'm still banned from Miss Stevenson's art class after a prank I played in my fourth year at St. Joan's. But apparently she's going to be joined by another teacher next year who I hope will let me do my A-level. There's also a wonderful new English teacher who gets us to recite poetry, and while everyone else mumbles it at the front of the class, I dress up in costume or theme my recitation, never knowingly underperformed. And I know exactly what I want to do next. I want to study drama, I tell Sister Angela.
Drama? She exclaims. What? What drama?
Acting, the theatre. I want to go to drama school.
But don't you cause enough drama as it is, Mary? Do you really want any more?
As I watch her face turn the colour of a tomato, I realise that I might as well have told Sister Angela that I wanted to be a prostitute. My acting ambitions are never mentioned again at school. I didn't dare tell my parents about my theatre ambitions either. Dancing, music and acting were hobbies, not real jobs. Dad would probably hit the roof, and Mum would worry that it wasn't steady enough. My mum was at the core of my universe as I grew up. She was the centre around which the six of us, my siblings, my dad and I, orbited. Sometimes sharing her with so many people frustrated me so much that I even volunteered to go to early Latin Mass on Sunday mornings just to be alone with her. Our house is endlessly filled with people coming and going, and the tiny kitchen with its red formica table and white butler sink is where Mum holds court, endlessly refilling the teapot and making visitors laugh until they almost cry. She offers them whatever she's baked that morning. Soda bread warm from the oven, Victoria sponge dripping with jam or flapjacks oozing butter, scones dotted with sultanas, rock buns or coffee and walnut cake. My mother's baking skills, combined with her sharp sense of humour, mean that a stream of friends, shopkeepers and acquaintances drop in, and the only time our house is quiet is when everyone is asleep. Mum's in bed, Michael said as I walked into the house after school one day, but I can't get an appointment with the doctor until tomorrow. Mum was lying on her bed as I walked in to see her. She is never ill. She looked pale and feverish, mumbling in a string of almost silent words that I couldn't understand. Mum, I said, are you okay? She clutched at her temples. I offered to go down the shop and get some lemonade. She stared at me, her eyes focusing on mine for a moment. What's lemonade? She said, and her eyes slid away from mine as she started to mutter again. I was completely confused. I spell it out. Lemonade. I tell her she loves it and that it's her favourite drink. But she didn't reply. Instead, she just kept muttering to herself, and fear solidified like ice inside me. The doctor's glasses are so thick they make his eyes look like frog spawn, and he has a frown on his face. He listens to Mum's heart and takes her temperature. Then he shines a light into her eyes and sits back down at his desk. He says he thinks Mum is going through the change, and that can make women get depressed and erratic. He gives her a prescription for some antidepressants and says to make sure she doesn't stay in bed. It will do her no good to be hiding away. She needs to be up and out. Women can suffer when they're going through the menopause, but they must not be allowed to wallow in it. She'll be fine in the next couple of weeks. His words ring in my head as we walk Mum back to the car. 2 weeks. Just 2 weeks. But the next morning, she's no better. I'm ringing an ambulance, says Michael. This isn't right. She's been like this for 3 days now, and I'm not going back to that doctor. There were no blue lights or racing speeds when the ambulance arrived. Michael phoned Dad to tell him what was happening and got into his car to follow the ambulance while I climbed inside it with Mum. It was only when she was pushed into casualty that the world turned upside down. What drugs has she had? A young doctor yelled at me as he looked at Mum. When we explained it was antidepressants, the doctor looks at the ambulance men pushing the trolley and he shouts at them to get her to the examination room. Now! We were sure that Mum would recover. She was in hospital and the doctors would make her well again. Even when they diagnosed her with meningitis, we didn't really understand what it meant. No one explained. No one sat us down to tell us how serious it could be. When a doctor told us that Mum had encephalitis as well as meningitis and might be brain damaged if she recovered consciousness, I watched my father's spirit ebb away with each word. When she contracted pneumonia and was moved into intensive care, he sat by her bed for hour after hour and waited for her to wake up. For 18 days, we sat waiting for Mum to open her eyes as we prayed using the rosary we'd tied to the end of her bed. I think of all the things that Mum knows how to do as I gently stroke her hand. How to get black currant stains out of white shirts. How to knit a striped jumper. How to make lemon curd. How to sew the hem on a skirt. And I've never asked her to teach me any of them because she is always there. I will, though, when she wakes up. Mum will show me. She always does. One evening, after visiting hours, we get a call from the hospital. We need to come down as soon as possible. My heart clenched inside me as the doctor walked in. Oh, not more bad news. Please don't tell us that she's got worse. I'm so sorry, the doctor said in a low voice as he looked at us. I stared at him, confused. What did he mean? I didn't understand. Mum had passed away peacefully about an hour ago, he explained. Did we want to go and see her? My head feels light, as if I'm at the highest point on a swing, suspended in the moment when you feel weightless for a second before plunging downwards. I stare at the doctor. Mum can't have died. It isn't possible. But then we walk into the room where she is lying still on a bed. My mother looks like one of those statues she spent a lifetime praying to. As we wordlessly watch, Dad sits on a chair beside her, stretches his body across hers, and starts to sob.
Mary Portis was reading from her autobiography, and tomorrow at the same time she struggles to keep her family together as they grieve for their mother. Shop Girl was abridged by Joe Coombs and produced by Hannah Marshall. It was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4.
In my 20s, the critics said I was brutal. In my 30s, they said I was flippant. My 40s...
BBC Radio 4 Extra explores the literary legacy and intriguing private life of one of the most successful English writers.
He was fascinated, really, by the life of the British Empire, the British abroad.
She had a husband who adored her, a wonderful position, all the money she could want, and she ran away with a married man.
The lives and work of Somerset Maugham. Made for BBC Radio 4 Extra. This Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7.
This is BBC Radio 4. Immigration was identified as the fourth biggest concern for women in a Women's Hour poll. After the news, Jane Garvey fills us in on how women think and feel about the issue and asks how the political parties are addressing it.